You're listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Welcome, everybody, to the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. I've met some of you, but not all of you before. My name is Milan Vaishnav. I'm an associate with the South Asia Program, relatively new. As some of you might know, over the summer, our South Asia Program tripled in size, meaning we added three people. Or I guess maybe quadrupled in size, actually. In any case, this is the second in a series of sort of new series of events, discussions on Indian domestic politics. Some of you were here last week when we had Christophe Jaffrelot speak about the regionalization of Indian politics. If any of you are not on our list and would like to be on our list for future events, please see my colleague Neda in the back or any one of us. And thanks for coming again today. Very pleased to welcome Anjana Sinha, who's come down from Philadelphia, where she is visiting the Center for the Advanced Study of India at the University of Pennsylvania. I think it's fair to say that the Naxalite issue in India is probably one of the least understood issues in contemporary Indian politics and society today. I think that's true in the policy community, and it's also true in the scholarly community, both in India, frankly, and abroad here in the United States. This is in spite of the fact, of course, that the Prime Minister very famously said that it was the largest and most important internal security threat facing India at the present time. And I think everybody recognizes that addressing the Naxal issue is important for not just the security and the future of the stability in the Indian state, but also on the promise of the Indian state to deliver a sort of inclusive economic development for its population. And we're lucky today to hear from one of the few people, really, who has been active in the addressing the Naxal issue for quite some time. It's rare for us, I think, in D.C. to get the chance to hear from somebody with this kind of background. Anjana Sinha is a security reform practitioner with over two decades of experience. She first joined the Indian police in 1990. And currently serves as Inspector General for Communication in Andhra Pradesh in southern India. As Chief of Police in Andhra, she has worked to neutralize over 20 leftist extremist groups and also was involved, quite interestingly, in helping to prevent an outbreak of communal violence in the early 90s during the Babri Masjid controversy, which hopefully we'll get to talk about. I know that's not your primary focus today. She also has wide experience beyond the Naxal issue, has been involved in arranging security for the Afro-Asian Games, worked to train police officials working at the United Nations in Bosnia, has it worked with the UN Office of Drugs and Crime on combating human trafficking, so has a very interesting and broad resume in addition to working on the Naxalite issue. So I think I'll hand it over to Anjana, who's going to talk for maybe about 30 to 35 minutes on her perspective on the fight, talk a little bit about the evolution of the movement and where it stands today with particular insight from southern India, and then we'll have hopefully plenty of time to open it up for discussion and Q&A. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Milan and Frederick, for giving me this opportunity to address what I would imagine a very, very informed and a very, very educated set of audience. Well, I will still keep my presentation very basic and very narrative because I would like to answer questions after a half an hour presentation. Is that okay? So the presentation, of course, is packed with slides because I just kept it as a good sort of arsenal for my other things which I might have to say later on. But it's basically in three parts. And the first part is going to be almost a chronicle of how and when the Naxal insurgency started, its highs and lows, and its present status in the country as it is. The second part is going to be basically what we have been able to, that's not necessarily the establishment or us talking about them, but it's rather what they think about themselves. So it's basically culling out of information from their documents. That's the second part of the presentation. And the last part of my presentation is about what we as of this establishment and the security community have been able to do and not been able to do. So that is going to be my presentation. So this has got a history of 42 years. It first started in 1967 in a state of West Bengal, which is the northeast state, and it was a very typical sort of militant outburst of a group of farmers against the landholding community. And this was very, very sort of almost, a romantic uprising as it was, supported by the students of the Presidency College, which is a very elite college in Calcutta. But just as sporadic and militant it was in 67, it also was quelled with an equal firm hand by the West Bengal government. What I'm trying to say is that it started in 67, and by 72, it was almost history in West Bengal. But it really didn't die down. We see the movement again raising its head in the state of Andhra Pradesh, which is almost synonymous to the Deccan Plateau of the India's geography, and it was pretty bad. But before that, I just want to say that as of today, it has assumed exponential proportions. It has almost affected 9 states of our country. And it has almost close to 30,000 armed guarders, is the assessment. In 2006, the Prime Minister of our country, as Milan rightly said, called it the greatest internal security challenge for the security forces of our country. So, as I said, there is something which is that much more menacing and intimidating about this insurgency in India, which is not about some of the erstwhile insurgencies in our country. India has been dealing with insurgencies right from its day of independence. So it had a lot of these secessionist groups which were very, very militant and insurgent, like the Nagas. Then we had the Sikh militancy. But all these were very effectively dealt, is what I'm trying to say. But for very unfortunate reasons, or reasons which I will explain subsequently, the Naxal insurgency, when it started in 67 and is continuing as of today in 2012, over a span of 4 decades, has not been effectively neutralized. So it is unique in that sense that despite the police forces in engaging with them, and when it was being engaged with, the specific state police or the security forces of the state police thought or assessed that it was effectively dealt with and it was almost over with, but it didn't happen. So in 72, when it finally finished and it raised its head in 80 in Andhra Pradesh, it came back with a far more force in terms of its guerrilla capability, in terms of its motivations, and in terms of its numbers. So while in 67 to 72, there were probably 14 policemen who were killed in the engagement with the Naxals, from 80 to 90, there were more than 200 policemen killed in Andhra Pradesh and Maharashtra. So, that is the kind of the level with which they came back. And in 2000, I'll show you some of the slides, in 2000 onwards, when the security forces have also started engaging with them in more than one state at a time, the casualties have actually multiplied that many more times. Of course, I will skip this slide because this is a typical, basically what they believe in, that they have to basically liberate some of these areas, and with the liberated areas in the periphery, they will then go at liberating what they call the capital. So this is how they believe in. So that was 67, West Bengal. Oops. This was 1980-85. And 10 years down the line, this is how it is. So today, the problem from from here, from 69 of this, three decades down the line, it's here. That's the magnitude of the problem. And from some 30 armed carders of 69-70 to 30,000 armed carders as of today. Now let me give you just very brief overview of the organization. They are very typically organized like any left movement. They have a Politburo, then they have their central committee, then they have their state committees and their divisions. But it's at the local level that they are different from a really left organization. They have what they call the Dalams or their armed squads. And these are all people of the local community who carry arms quite openly. And they are almost like a parallel authority to, let's say, the local police there or the local other government officials. Their supplies of arms comes mostly, I mean, I would say primarily, from looting the Indian security establishments, basically attack on police stations, attack on police armories, and that's where they get most of their weapons from. And they have a huge amount of sophisticated arms, and most of the arms which we recover from, the police has recovered from them, has shown that they are essentially the police police weapons and weapons issued. But having said that, over a span of these three to four decades, there have been recoveries made which have Chinese signatures, and arms which were of the same sequence of arms which was being used by the LTTE, the Tamil Tigers of Sri Lanka. But these have been very stray incidents of recoveries. Sorry. I think I pressed the wrong one.
You're back.
Yeah. This is their formation. So if we see that the theater of conflict spreading over to nine states has been after 2004-2005. And if we see how these groups were in 1980 was, actually it was the PW, which was formed by somebody called Kondapalli Sitaramaya in Andhra Pradesh. And there were these splinter, sort of very marginal left groups across the country. But they seem to have really consolidated and found what is called political common ground in 2004. And that's when their offensive vis-a-vis the Indian state has really become that much more sort of tangible and realistic. So we see very clearly that from 2004, the movement and the insurgency has acquired national proportions. Now this is how they operate. This is their modus operandi. They believe what is called the final positional war, when they will be able to take over the parliament and put their flag over the Red Fort. Red Fort is the symbol of the Indian sovereignty, and on our days of Independence Day and celebration of Republic Day, that's where the head of the state unfurls the national flag. So that is the point where they want to reach, and they consider themselves that they have already reached what is called the mobile war stage, where there has been a basic foundation already laid of sort of mobilizing opinion at a certain level amongst larger sections of the Indian population. So these are, of course, not very clearly defined phases according to them, but the guerrilla warfare phase sort of lapses into the mobile warfare phase, and there will be a time in future as they perceive that there will be a mobile warfare phase which will lapse or which will fuse into a positional warfare, and that's when they want to finally have the Indian state overthrown by what they call the National Democratic Revolution. So this is how they perceive and envision their goal. And they believe that right now they are quite in control of the forest or the countryside and the interior areas of the states where they are operational. And they are slowly moving from the countryside into the urban centers. And that is when they will also liberate the urban centers and take over. I think I will skip that. Yeah, what I want to say is that this insurgency is that much more dangerous because while they have what is called their organizational structure, which has a very strict control of democratic centralism in their parlance, but their local squads are quite independent to take actions and to do things which they obviously need to account to their senior formation subsequently, but then they have to definitely say why did they do it. And therefore, in effect, what happens is that a lot of killings take place. And a lot of these decisions of killing, let's say, a police official, killing a politician at a local level in a state, are very independent decisions taken by these squads. And it has very dangerous and, you know, difficult ramifications. So these squads are quite independent, and they obviously take actions keeping in mind its response and its sort of impact on the local population. So obviously they don't just go and hit and kill a person or do something which is not going to be going well with the community. So their actions would be typically killing a very unscrupulous, a very unpopular politician. You know, somebody who's been perpetrating a lot of unjust things or is rank corrupt or, you know, is just way too difficult to be handled by the Indian government or the state. Or they go ahead and kill a police official who's considered extremely draconian or autocratic. So that their actions are very dangerous, very, very sort of fascist, if I can call that. But at the same time, something which should not sort of distance them from the local population. So they believe that their support has to be from the people and everything has to flow out of the people. So, and of course, they just operate within a certain terrain, and the terrain is, they use the terrain to their advantage. I think I will skip this slide too. I'll go back to this. I mean, I just want everybody to have a look at how from 89 to 2000, what the killings were. I mean, let's even forget the security forces, insurgents, and the civilian killing, but just look at the numbers from 3000 to 11,000. That is over one decade, the first big chunk, and these are, of course, annual figures given because that data, I did not have it sort of annually, so I couldn't sort of segregate it. But this is the data that I have. That is the kind of casualties which has gone up over two decades. I mean, 89 to 2000 vis-a-vis 2002 to 2012. This is the other graph which I wanted people to sort of pay attention to. That if you see that the number of killings really went quite high from 2005-6. And as I have mentioned in my earlier slide, that they really consolidated their splinter groups into one organization, which they formally announced as the CPIM, which is Communist Party of India Maoist, and when all the groups came together, and they sort of formulated in their internal meeting that this is the time to launch the national offensive against the Indian state, as it was. And that's when they started operating in almost 5 to 6 states. And from 2005 to now, they have expanded over 9 states of the country. So that's the period when the number of casualties, because of the engagement with far many police forces across the country, number of killings of people, and the security forces went up many times over. That is how the organization looks like. If we notice, I don't have too much of information about it, but if we notice, they definitely have a clear what is called an international department, and it has 2 people. Now, this is how the establishment sort of really perceives the problem. We, of course, have our stream of security, conservative perspective. Then we have the radical perspective, which is also synonymous to their perspective of what they think of. And then we, of course, have their what is called the development perspective. I think I would like to place my assessment of what the nature of conflict is more between all the three. And I think today the Naxal problem or the Naxal insurgency has picked up with so much of sort of ferocity and so much of a larger base, as it was, because of not sheer poverty, but because of poverty which has not been addressed, and because of other development issues and malgovernance in particular. I think it's the failure of the Indian government and the Indian government agencies who have not delivered, especially in the rural areas and in the interior areas of our country, that today we see this growing of insurgency in such a in a much larger, in a much more sort of radical way than in other states. So merely saying that it is directly correlated to poverty will not be true, will not be correct. But I think it's malgovernance added to poverty and added to lack of development, which has led to the festering of militancy and insurgency of the Naxal strain in our country. So their modus operandi also is to typically pick on issues which have a lot of popular appeal amongst the people. So let's say in 67 when they started, there was a lot of exploitation of an oppression of the tilling class, of people who were landless laborers in the agrarian sector, who were the basic cadres of this movement. Whereas now, as of today, let's say in the past 5 years, there's a lot of tribal mobilization. So the cadres and the composition of the cadres quite changed. It's got a very different demographic than what it was in the 60s. So now you have a lot of tribals who are not just part of the movement directly, but also who are large-scale sympathizers of the insurgency. So depending on what they consider as the issues of that area, which will mobilize popular opinion, the Naxals have they really have this potential of taking these issues and taking them as their own issues. And they typically operate by forming these organizations which are very issue-based, which are amongst the women, which are amongst the labor of a factory. So they'll have labor unions, they'll have Mahila Sangams, which is basically women's organizations. They will have Bal Sangams, which is basically children's organizations in the field of, let's say, where schools are not working. And through these organizations and these issues, they mobilize opinion. I think I kind of already spoke about this, but I'll just put it formally once more. Yes. So it's not poverty which is the direct cause, but it's context which is important. So while poverty is important, poverty is not the only reason why there is Naxalism. There are clearly many areas of our country which are far more poor, or were areas which were much poorer, let's say, than Andhra Pradesh in the 80s, where there was no semblance of Naxal insurgency. So poverty definitely provided the context, but there were other issues which were basically the failure of the government to deliver, which were crux in sort of building that antipathy of the people vis-a-vis the government, and this antipathy being mobilized for support for the insurgency. This is very interesting. This is all from their internal documents, is what I wanted to share with all of you. Now, they have their documents where they plan what they call the grand strategy for taking over the Indian state or bringing about the National Democratic Revolution, and they have their sort of tactics also laid down. Now, obviously, their larger strategy is to overthrow the state through a violent mean or through a protracted people's war. And when there was just the PWG, they had this vision of that 1975 was their goalpost when they would be able to sort of reach the final stage of the NDR. But in 2004, in their meeting, they have revised. They had a meeting which went on for 3 or 4 days somewhere in the forest, where they came together, formally announced themselves as a single platform or a single political organization, and they have raised their flagpole to say that we will now be able to achieve this by 2016. We are already in 2012. It's not going to happen, is for sure, is another matter. But the fact of the matter is that they actually even sort of verbalize, and they have this plan in their minds that in 2016 they want to overthrow the democratic political system of India and bring about what they call the people's government. Now, obviously, they also accept in their own document that their strategy has been a failed offensive. They call it the failed offensive. But they still want to improve on their capability. And their minimal capability are things like they have been able to overtake a jail. In Bihar, there's a place called Jahanabad. They were able to actually sort of break into a jail, just sort of storm into the place and get 64 prisoners out from a high security jail. They have broken into 10 Food Corporation of India godowns. FCI is an India's food agency which stores all its grains, which is procured by the Indian government. So in Orofkonda, they were able to storm into 10 godowns at one point of time, spread over almost 25 kilometers, take away 3,000 bags of food grains and distribute it to the villagers in about 10 villages. So this is their minimum capability. They are capable of doing, and mind you, these are sort of examples I'm picking off of the year 2007, 2005. Nayagarh, they have broken into a district police office of, which is like the police headquarters of a district, and taken away more than 100 weapons. That is in Nayagarh. So that is the kind of capability they have. And with not being met with what is called sufficient resistance. Of course, there was resistance, but obviously it was overcome by these people. And their belief is to keep on raising their minimum capability, constantly upgrading their minimum capability. So that is the kind of framework within which they function. I think I've already spoken about how they like to use controversial or populist issues and sort of mobilize opinion on that. They also like to very actively get involved in elections, though they themselves do not believe in the electoral politics and do not join in any kind of elections in any of the states. They definitely become part of the larger electoral campaign, always against the ruling party. So it is not party-based. It is that if X political party is in government in a state, they will ensure that that political party is thrown off. Like, I can quote the example of Andhra Pradesh. In 2004, the elections, the Congress came back with a thumping majority. And this was after a two-tenure, which is an eight-year stint of another political party called the TDP. But apart from the fact that there were a lot of anti-incumbency of the TDP as a political party, the TDP was immobilized by the PWG. It was the PWG then, because they hadn't come out as a CPIM party formally. So the People's War, at that point of time, ensured and demobilized most of the people from the TDP who were campaigning. They killed a couple of them. They terrorized people from going to the villages in the interior parts to ensure that TDP was not able to take forward its political campaign. So in net effect, what happened, while it did not openly support the Congress, it kind of facilitated the Congress to get that much more extra votes or whatever. The other thing which is very, very typical and unique of the Naxal insurgency is that they're also anti-development. And I can say this because they ensure that they are against roads being built into villages. They mobilize villagers against getting roads built. They mobilize villagers against government officials coming into interior areas. For the moment, since the forests and the lands in the forests are being taken away by big corporates or by larger government institutions, their current slogan is not to allow the forest officials or not to allow the mining officials into these areas. Now, if a survey has to be conducted for getting to know what is the potential of a certain area, you'd need to have these engineers, these scientists, these officials go into those areas. But they just leverage the antipathy of the people vis-a-vis the government officials and ensure to build up that opinion against these kind of people coming in. So obviously when these officials or these personnel who are expected to come and do the survey or to be able to make assessments are prevented clearly from coming in, where is the question of trying to take any project forward? So they are definitely anti-development. That is something which is very, very interesting. While they espouse the cause of, you know, the poor not being getting their due from the government, they're clearly ensuring that some of these little steps which the government wants to take development forward into interior areas, they are able to mobilize public opinion against that. The other thing which is of equal import is that they quite often align with Islamic and militant Islamic organizations. So one would see them supporting things like, right now again coincidentally, there's a communal issue brewing up in the city of Hyderabad where I come from. There is the Charminar. I'm getting a little anecdotal, so please give me that 2 minutes extra. But Charminar is a 350-year-old monument. It's a heritage. But within Charminar's, you know, the precincts, there is a small Ram temple, which has also been there for probably not as old as 350 years, but definitely a century old. Now suddenly the Hindu fundamentalists decided to make it a little more ornate or a little more sort of festive, and they started making additions to it. Obviously, this has upset the Muslim community. And so there have been a little bit of conflict and communal tension in the city. But I was just speaking to a colleague of mine, and he works with an organization. We have an organization which only monitors the Naxals. And he told me that it's surprising that some of these people were found sort of supporting the riffraffs, you know, who indulge in stone pelting or throwing off bottles or Molotov cocktails, whatever, basically creating a riotous situation, that some of these cadres of the Naxal insurgency were found moving in Hyderabad during these few days. So, but I was not surprised, because this is typical of them. They always like to associate themselves with, you know, with volatile situations and volatile issues, and get political mileage out of that. The other thing is that they always very vocally espouse causes of human rights, and especially human rights which hit the international sort of forums. And that is something which is very tricky, because sometimes, while these are very legitimate issues, the kind of support it gathers is from organizations like this. And that is something which everybody has to be very careful of. I mean, I could give an example of Binayak Sen. Binayak Sen was one of the... He's a doctor by profession, and he used to basically treat a lot of patients and a lot of people free of cost, basically very pro-poor. And he was picked up by the Chhattisgarh government with very sort of solid documents of having clear linkages with the Naxals. And he was inside in the judicial custody, which is basically inside jail for more than a year. Now, there was a lot of international uproar and sort of lot of furore against Binayak Sen being arrested, because there was enough and more support for him, and personally speaking, rightfully so, for being picked up and for being incarcerated for more than a year, for just because the fact that he was treating his plea, and his advocate's plea was that he just treated anybody and everybody who came to him or stayed in his nursing home because they were just another tribal or another villager or somebody. But the prosecuting agencies had enough and very concrete substantive evidence to prove in the court that he had very clear linkages with the insurgents. So the lot of noise and the lot of opinion building for Binayak Sen was done by these groups. Of course, I mean, I personally think that that was probably right, because, I mean, he really wasn't clearly a terrorist or an insurgent. But the fact that they can mobilize opinion at an international level on human rights issues has its flip side too. That's the nuanced understanding one should have of these people. I think I'll skip this, because this is... Yeah, this is something which I wanted to bring it to. This is their typical way of operating, and that's why the Indian state's failure has been not to recognize this. That when they realize that the security forces, and in their parlance is the enemy, advances, withdraw. So typically in West Bengal, when there was effective police engagement with these insurgents, they, of course, were killed. A lot of them were killed, but then they also sort of kind of just withered away or disappeared into the large population. When they realized that the security or the establishment is taking it easy, then they start sort of mobilizing and they start sort of getting on top of things. When they are complacent, typically in Andhra Pradesh, I have seen that police stations were attacked at early hours of the morning. That's when, you know, the beat patrol constable has finished his job. He has come and kept his thing, but his duty gets over at 6 o'clock in the morning. He's dozing off. Somebody who's supposed to be attending to the walkie-talkie, the wireless, at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, really nothing is happening. Most of the paperwork is over. He's taking it easy. The driver, the sentry, who's supposed to be alert because he's also taking it easy. That's the time. 3 to 5 in the morning typically was the time when all police stations were attacked. So they normally try to strike when everybody is taking it easy. And especially when your chips are down or when definitely the underdog, they pursue. And as they've picked it up from Mao Zedong itself, that state armories are our armories. So their best bet of weaponizing themselves and arming themselves is the state. So just go. They have attacked, they have gone into ordnance factories, picked up explosives, they have gone into magazines of various mining organizations, Geological Survey of India, they have attacked explosive magazines, taken away detonators, taken away explosives. This is their typical modus operandi.
It's 4:15 almost. Do you want to...
Okay. I will keep all this for later questions. No, what I basically wanted to come at was that this is a group which has got very, very dangerous potential, as is clear from one part of a tiny state in India to 9 larger states of the country. They have already expanded, and from 30 armed cadres to 30,000 armed cadre, this is their growth in 30 years. The Indian state has failed to meet the challenge. But having said that, I can say that the Indian state was actually able to recognize the problem as late as 2004-05. And it was only, I think, in 2006 that the Indian Prime Minister actually verbalized it. So it's been indeed the failure of the Indian state to have recognized the potential of the problem, to really study the prognosis in the early years. And therefore, today we have a problem which is indeed a national security problem on hand. One of the reasons why I feel that the Indian state has failed to engage with the problem effectively is that we have not been able to do what is called our counterinsurgency properly and effectively. And that's where I like to use this very sort of theatrical, that it can, I mean, we don't have to give them an antidote, so it cannot be a tit for tat. It has to be something more smarter than a tit for tat. So we just have to be just one up the insurgents to be able to deal with them effectively. And while the security forces have been engaging, the civil administration of the government has not been sensitized to their active role in addressing the problem. They have not been sensitized to be working in tandem with the security forces for addressing the counterinsurgency. For, of course, there are various reasons for it. The other part, which has been the failure of the security forces per se, is that we have not been able to deal with the problem. We have just been engaging with the insurgents and not with the entire situation, the entire scenario. And that's why a typical paramilitary or a typical armed police engagement with the insurgents have been that, okay, there is this squad which is moving in this area. This entire state has X number of squads, so we just need to neutralize those squads, those armed squads, and the problem is taken care of. I think that's where we have had our failing and we've missed the bus. We really need to address the whole issue of winning the people of that area vis-a-vis just neutralizing or eliminating the insurgents. And that is where I think the Indian security forces have missed the bus. And eventually in what I say, building long-term relationships with the community is something which doesn't come through the uniform forces very naturally, and especially to the local police. And this is where we have not been able to address the issue very effectively. So So my question to the enlightened audience, and especially to this think tank, would be that you should be able to tell us how to best engage with a situation like this. And it's just not about dealing with insurgency, but it's about dealing with revolutionary politics. And we have been failing in, you know, using typical, it's not very easy, by the way. Counterinsurgency itself is probably more difficult than taking on and fighting a conventional war. It's much more difficult than taking on a sheer aggression or even defending in a conventional war situation. Because it's a much bigger battle on many fronts, which is being fought, but it's not even being fought openly. That's the trick of the entire thing. And I my personal experience has been that the Indian security forces, especially the local police and the civil police, we have not been able to use propaganda, buyout, co-option, red herring, which are very sort of laid down SOPs of an effective counterinsurgency very effectively. What right now we are doing is just locating the insurgents, surrounding them, and taking care of them, neutralizing them. That has actually sort of exemplified and amplified the problem much more than really dealing with the situation. So, I mean, we have to deal with what they themselves call the protracted people's war. So a protracted people's war has to be sort of countered by a protracted, you know, I think a people's war, but a people's war against the insurgent. So I think we really have to turn the protracted people's war around and give it to them rather than they giving it to the state. So I have these two examples, and I was just telling Frederick and Milan before I entered that we have two guerrilla movements in two countries in New America or Latin America, that is in Peru and in Mexico, which have very, very uncanny resemblances to the Naxals in India. But in my opinion, I think India is a far more stable state politically and economically than Peru and Mexico. Yes, we are far more stable. But while these countries have been able to possibly deal with it better, if not more effectively, we in India are still grappling with the Naxal sort of situation, and we are probably not at a stage where we can say that we'll be able to effectively sort of write them off very soon in future. So these are some of the unresolved issues. We have been able to harness a bit of technology towards operations, but we have not really sort of use it very optimally. It's not so popular. It's not even very familiar with the people who use it. And some of our security forces engaging has had a lot of collateral damages, as it's termed, which has not been very good for the credibility and the reputation of the police forces themselves. There have been huge gaps in coordination. And at the end of the day, what is the kind of money? It is estimated that the government from 2005, the Indian government has spent close to 1,000 crores or 1,200 crores, I think 1,000 crores, in just trying to deal with the insurgency in central India. But we are still grappling with the situation. That's what I have to say.
Thanks very much. Thank you very much. Before opening it up or to sort of get the discussion started, could you just, you know, on basically any issue that you care about, you'll find a tremendous amount of variation at the state level and at the sub-state level in India. One of the things that's been noticeable is that there's a lot of variation in the success with which law enforcement has been able to tackle the threat. So if you see the failures in Chhattisgarh or Jharkhand, other places, contrasted with Andhra, which has actually had some documented success. If you were to sort of boil down what some of the principal elements of the sort of coin strategy was in Andhra that worked, and that perhaps shed some light on what lessons could be learned for other state governments, what are sort of the three or four things that you would have, you know, at the top of that list?
Yes, I think that's a very good question. And indeed, in this entire sort of 4 decades of this movement, if the Indian establishment or any of the Indian establishments can actually claim that we've had successes, it's been the Andhra Pradesh experiment. Andhra Pradesh is one state in India. Does it have a pointer? That's the area. Hyderabad, Warangal, Nizamabad. Maybe if I go back to the first slide. Is there one way of going back to the first slide? Anyways, forget it. I'll just put this here. That's also part of the difference. It's a large state. It's got a lot of hills. It's got a lot of sort of forests. And basically a hilly terrain. And it took the Andhra Pradesh 15 years to effectively deal. So it's not that it's happened in 5-year span of time or something. From 80, that's when the problem started. And it was only sometime in 92, 93 that, you know, they were actually the underdogs and they were really down and out, but not dead or gone. So it has taken Andhra Pradesh also 15 years. But my belief is that the Andhra Pradesh police also started from the same sort of levels of competence and capabilities as most of the state forces are. But we had we had very competent leaders, police leaders, at that point of time, who were able to recognize the problem and who were able to make what is called short-term investments and then long-term investments. So while we immediately formed what is called a specialized force, it's called the Greyhounds, and it's right now a very reputed group which is being actually replicated, and the blueprint of Greyhound is being studied across the country for creating similar forces. It was the creation of Greyhounds, which was a dedicated force, anti-Naxal trained force. It was trained by the military school of jungle warfare by the Indian Army for 1 year. So while 1 year, the offensive of the Naxals was very high, the Greyhound was getting trained and oriented to take on the insurgents. And when they came back, they really went full hog, and they were able to engage with the insurgents very effectively. Now this happened because of a DGP, who is the chief of the state police, who was able to figure that out. This is not very difficult, but similar things have not happened in the other 6 to 7 or 8 states of India, though they have been grappling with the problem also now close to a decade. So it is the inertia of bureaucracy, it is the sheer inertia of taking decisions, quickly implementing them and putting them into action, I think was where AP had the clear advantage, and it was because of we had good professional leaders. And of course, therefore, putting on young superintendents of police in the districts who would be able to sort of understand the nuance, because every district is different. The problems of every district are different. So as I mentioned earlier, that these Naxals typically pick on the local issues to mobilize opinion and alienate the community from the government. Imaginative SPs were, or at least young imaginative SPs were put on the job who would be able to bridge this gap, who would be able to ensure that this alienation of the community from the local police or from the local government is kind of kept at minimal. So we as SPs were encouraged, and we were actually instructed to engage a lot with the community, and we got into this community building exercises. And I think that helped us a lot. More than that, we as chiefs of police of a district, we were given a mandate which was way beyond just mere policing. So we were given the prerogative of being able to get some development issues also implemented in the area. Typically, if there's a tube well required, a well required, a hospital required in a village or in a block of block which has a few villages, it is the job of the district collector. It's the job of the district administration. But I, as an SP, I've had the dubious distinction of writing to the collector that I visited this village and five tube wells are required in this village, and I visited this block and the hospital's ambulance is not working, so the ambulance needs to be put in place. And based on the letter of the superintendent of police, the collector used to immediately put these things in place. So, which is not the normal role of the police. But as SPs, we were all told to do that, and our letters or our recommendations to the civil administration was responded to. So this kind of a practice really well worked very much, and it went a long way in sort of bridging that gap between the government and the community, the local population. And this was something which was immensely sort of disturbing to the Naxals. But, well, unfortunately, I do not know, this kind of practices have not been sort of emulated by the other states. So, as I mentioned, counterinsurgency is not about just gaining territory, but it's also sort of winning the minds and hearts, which is said often and enough by people in from COIN, school of thought. But it's easier said than done, but it's definitely doable, it's possible. So these were some of the things we did.
That's great.
I could give a few more examples.
Well, I want to make sure people have adequate time. So if you could just identify yourself, your name, and your affiliation when you ask your question. Rick.
Okay. Ms. Sinha, thank you for that presentation. This is definitely, as Milan mentioned, a topic we don't often get to hear in Washington, so very much appreciate it. You mentioned how the Naxalites work very hard to try to get support at the local level where they're operating. But I'm wondering whether you feel that they've also had some success in generating that kind of support among the educated and the ruling classes. You know, I can think of several times over dinners in New Delhi with folks that are in the policy process or near it, and they talk about some of these attacks and saying that they actually righted a local wrong. And, you know, that kind of sends shivers down my spine that some people that are educated and in this process in Delhi seem to have also bought in that these are Robin Hoods rather than rebels. I'm wondering whether or not you've seen that. Is that maybe just a couple of things that I've seen and not really indicative, or is that a concern that the police forces have that maybe there is this perception that's growing among the elites that the Naxals are doing some good work, in fact?
No, you're absolutely right. I think the security community and the intelligence community in India is absolutely recognized and informed of this this sympathy which is amongst the intelligentsia and the what you call the educated ruling classes. It is a matter of concern because it is there, it's very much there, and they definitely therefore muster that kind of support even amongst that sort of top layer of the Indian social setup. But I mean, I think it's a concern, but which really has not been clearly addressed, because not too many people who might be sort of voicing their support are clearly sort of providing that kind of logistical support or thing, which let's say somebody like Abhinayak Sen did. Because there is also the so-called intelligentsia and this people who live in Delhi or who are affluent and the elite, as it were, they also realize that the Indian police can get very draconian, that willy-nilly if you do get caught. So I think, well, there is some amount of monitoring of who could be the potential supporters, and that's how Abhinayak Sen got sort of trapped. So not too many people, while they express their opinions openly about what is leading to this kind of an frustration, which is getting manifested in insurgency and which is spreading so much, I don't think they go beyond just expressing their sympathy. But it's very much there, yes. Yes.
Please.
Thank you very much. In your description, your narrative of the growth of the Naxalite movement, it's almost word for word the history of the Chinese Communist Party, the 449. And so many of the Indian intellectuals and intelligentsia are very familiar with the history of the Chinese Communist Party. So I have two questions. One is, despite this very laudable decentralization that you've spoken about, is there any one leader, ideological or decision maker, who's deciding that? And the second question I have is there a sense of inevitability that the people's war will succeed because the Indian state has become so degenerate? That the Prime Minister himself has spoken about malgovernance. Everybody speaks about it. It's not something that can be hidden. And I guess it's beyond your brief to talk about the causes of it. But I'm asking, is there a sense of inevitability that a people's war, a successful people's war, might indeed solve some of the problems that India has? And is there any equivalent of a Mao Zedong?
Okay. I have a small clarification for your first part of the question, which is that when you're talking of the single leader, are you talking of the single leader from their side or from the Indian side? Of course, Mupalla Lakshman Rao, alias Ganapati, everybody knows that he is the undisputed leader of the CPIM. Maoist. Everybody knows that. I mean, there is, on their command and control, I don't think, they may be having their internal dissensions, but they clearly keep it under check. I mean, people say, now that we're talking about it, people say that one of the reasons why they had so many casualties in West Bengal was because the West Bengal State Committee leader, that is Kishanji, was getting too large for his boots, and probably one of the reasons why he wasn't given that kind of tactical or that tech protection by the Central Committee was because they felt that, okay, it's time for him to go. So within the CPIM, they have a very clear command and control as of now, that they have a leadership. They may have differences within their own Politburo or their state committee, central committees, but they clearly go by the diktats of what is decided by their central committee. Whereas on our side, that is what we need to be an effective counterinsurgency, force. Yes. We need a single, clear authority. And where the mandate has to be a little larger than just, dealing with people who are wearing their boots or uniform. It has to be, we don't have that. Your second question, well, I don't think it's inevitable. I don't think we are going to go the Chinese path, no way. That is, the Indian government is sort of not that ineffective. It could be a state with a lot of sort of incapacities. It is definitely not a very strong and assertive state as it ought to be. But I don't think the Indian state will allow the natural insurgency to sort of really grow and fester. In fact, one of the reasons why it has been addressed now at the national level is indeed because they realized willy-nilly that, yes, it is indeed becoming a problem much bigger than just one state or two states, but it's actually growing. So, and therefore the engagement, when Chidambaram became the Home Minister, they planned what is called the Integrated Action Plan, IAP, in which on these 1,000 crores annually apparently was allocated for various things, apart from just armed engagement with the Naxals. But so that sense of inevitability, no, definitely no. We will be able to sort of somehow,
muddle along.
Yeah, muddle along. We should be able to sort of not allow them to get there.
There's one back down the corner.
Thanks. I'm Alan Crossett, Congressional Research Service. Madam, I wanted to ask a question kind of growing out of the table or graph you had on the casualties. One is I didn't really hear you mention the term terrorism. I don't know if that was intentional in your approach to conceiving it. I know some in India are happy to label Naxalites terrorists. But in the context of terrorism being defined as taking either indiscriminate attacks or attacks targeting civilians. So first question is if you could kind of comment on that aspect. The other is that it seemed from your graph that the civilian deaths were far outweighed the security force or insurgents. And given your point about how important it is for this insurgency to have support from the people, I wondered, you know, it seems counterintuitive that they would grow over a period that civilians are taking the brunt of the beating here. So if you could also comment on that aspect, and maybe do you have a sense of what proportion of civilian deaths are caused by insurgent attacks, or are they caused by security forces? Thanks.
You want me to go back to the slide, or is it just to talk without the slide?
As
okay,
you will.
I'll answer your second question first. It's easier to answer. I think the civilian deaths always happen when there is a insurgency being fought or engaged with, because there is collateral damage. I mean, in the crossfire, literally and metaphorically, the civilians do get caught. But what I'm saying, the metaphoric crossfire, is that a lot of these deaths are because when the security forces are clearly engaging with the insurgents then start trying to sort of deflect their ire and their military ire on the civilians by saying that so-and-so is an informant, is aligned with the police forces or with the security, and they start killing them. And in the Naxal insurgency particularly, this has been very, very rampant, that a lot of people who are seen as not supporting them or not aligning with them in an area which is clearly what they perceive as their dominance area, they start eliminating those people. So apart from what is called the collateral damage, when there is indeed an engagement and a crossfire in which you have come and sort of the security forces have come and hit one camp of the insurgents, clearly there are some people who are bringing them food, people who have been brought there to cook their food, people who provide them news because they read newspapers every day, come what may. So they have some, their couriers who bring. So these kind of innocent people do get killed. But apart from that kind of engagement, you have people who get killed by the insurgents who are termed as informants or who are termed as class enemies because they are, you know, supposedly with the security forces or with the government agencies. So that's why, indeed, when there is effective engagement of the insurgents with the counterinsurgents, this is bound to happen. That's my answer to your question. The first question, well, I think there is a nuanced distinction between a terrorist and an insurgent. I mean, I think the terrorist will clearly do an act to terrorize, whereas an insurgent will do an act to maybe sort of mobilize opinion in his favor. So he will try to gain sympathy, and therefore his intent is that much more different than that of a terrorist. I mean, that's the only difference I can see. Otherwise, in terms of the acts per se, they are as terrorizing or, you know, as sort of sensational as the act of terror. But it's the intent where I would, you know, distinguish an insurgent from a terrorist. The terrorist clearly does something to sort of ensure that everybody runs away in the opposite direction. Whereas an insurgent's act is actually to probably sort of engage more people. And engage more people more sympathetically.
Please.
Tom Timberg, consultant. There was an extremely stimulating session, and I hope that perhaps we can get a chance to see some more of your overheads. Maybe you have them on the web or something. You can read them.
I could leave the presentation behind, and please, by all means, everybody can have a look at the data, statistics.
But, and there were so many things that it suggested to me, but the biggest thing was, you seem to be talking as if the responsibility is entirely that of the police. I mean, where is the collector? As far as I know, the Naxalites have kidnapped two collectors so far. I don't know if they've kidnapped any SPs yet, or IGs.
They don't believe in kidnapping. They just believe in killing them.
Well, but they do kidnap collectors.
Collectors, yes.
So right. In fact, it's a fundraising operation, I gather,
yes,
essentially, because none of them have been killed. They've all been ransomed, essentially. But as I say, I mean, you would think, And, for example, in the periods where state governments have taken very firm anti-communal things, what you usually do is you have an intelligence unit in the home ministry at the state level and maybe even coordinated with the center, working with all, as you say, and the thing that makes it even more surprising is, after all, the Indian Police Service and the Indian Administrative Service are essentially from the same barrel. It's the same exam that the people come from, so you would think that they would be able to work together. Anyway, that was one point. But the other one is a question of continuity. It sounds to me that there is relatively little continuity, or indeed 30 years, but relatively little continuity in Andhra. Is it Telangana, where the Naxalites are strong, or is it, in fact, in tribal areas?
So the first one was just a comment. I completely,
yeah.
I'm on the same page as you as far
right.
as when you say that, indeed, it seems to be as if it's the police's job to ensure that insurgency doesn't sort of stay, which is definitely, you know, saying only, you know, half the story, because indeed insurgency is a direct byproduct of malgovernance, which should be basically the, you know, it is the prerogative of the civil administration and the collector in the Indian situation. So I couldn't agree with you more. The second, in Andhra Pradesh, one, the tribal areas are in Telangana.
And so in the Telangana, since 48, 49, it was the same areas that were affected?
You mean the Telangana uprising?
You're right.
And yes, in the Telangana uprising, it was also the issues of land reforms or, mm-hmm. you know, the oppressed, the tilling class. So the geographic area was the same,
uh-huh.
really. It is also the area which is predominantly tribal, though we do have large pockets of tribal areas in Vishakhapatnam and Srikakulam area, which is the coastal Andhra.
Right.
We have a little bit of tribal belt in the Palnad area, which is the hinterland, Guntur and Ongole area. But these are small pockets. But the large sort of spread of the tribal area is indeed in Telangana. And yes, I mean, when you say that, it actually occurs to me that there seems to be a continuity in uprisings in different forms in this area. And now, indeed, we have the Telangana sort of, you know, mm-hmm. agitation for a separate state. So that's interesting.
I was, of course, and the final, just again, really a comment, is we note that both Peru and Mexico, the areas affected, are also Indian, essentially tribal areas outside of the mainline so-called mestizo cultures of both countries. So, in fact, you may have even more in common.
Yeah, I mean, that is something which I really would like to hear from all of you, because you definitely have more exposure and experience. That, you know, this occurred to me just while I was, you know, one day doing something of my own, that there are some very uncanny resemblances to the Peru and the Mexico situation. And, well, if they have been able to deal with it, so should we be able to. But we haven't been able to really deal with it. In India, it's actually been growing. So that's...
You touched on an interesting point, and that's the pressures within cultural groups in India and within the states for separate states. And of course, the government of India has neatly dealt with some of the problem by clipping off some of the problem areas in MP, for example, and creating very, very impecunious states which have trouble dealing with these sorts of things. They just don't have the resources. In the Telangana situation, if the Telugu area breaks off, that's another area which speaks the same language but doesn't have a lot of resources within the tribal areas. So that's really not the best way of solving the problem. I've been there, done that kind of thing in previous lives. The folks in the Ministry of Home Affairs in Delhi, with whom we've discussed these sorts of issues, are willing to fob it off and saying, oh, that's a state problem. You don't have to go talk to the state police organizations. And the state police organizations internally may be able to communicate with one another, but they can't communicate with the state organization in the immediate next door state. And that's a definite shortcoming in the lack of communications, lack of logistics support.
Completely. I've spoken of the coordination and the communication gap. One of the reasons why we have not been able to address this issue is because we literally do not speak to each other. And if I have to speak to my counterpart, I have to go through MHA, which is like, you know, by the time you tell the MHA that there is this group which needs to be sort of neutralized, the group is gone elsewhere. So
the big lesson that I've drawn from the Indian situation as well as others is don't bring foreigners in to fight your battles.
Well, we need not get the foreign troops or the boots to fight, but we can always use their sort of mind and their ideas. There's nothing wrong in doing that, and I think we should be doing that.
Yeah, the United States has a very similar problem in a place called Afghanistan. It's not working very well.
Marla.
Hi, my name is Marla Spivak. I'm from the Center for Global Development, and I sort of have two questions that touch on this issue. What I was curious about, and maybe I'm just ignorant of the way that the Indian state decided to deal with this, but how did it come to be that this was the police responsibility as opposed to the military's responsibility? It seems to me that it is an existential threat to the sovereignty of the state, even though it's within the state's borders, and I could see where the tension would arise, but what's the role of the Indian military in responding to this? And also, I was curious if the police or other institutions have reached out to the United States or the UK, other states that have dealt with COIN operations, and if you look for assistance from people with more experience.
So again, I will answer the second part of your question first. No, the Indians and the Indian government has not sought anybody's help or any assistance or any even, you know, expression of ideas as to how to deal with this Naxal insurgency. Having said that, your first question requires a bit of telling you about how the Indian system works. Law and order is, in India, we have different, you know, sort of categorization of subjects. And the Indian Union is, again, you know, we have the federal, which are the what is called the union subjects, central subjects, and we have what is called the state subjects. And there are something which is in between, which is called the concurrent subject. Now, ideally speaking, I think law and order should be a concurrent subject, but it isn't. It is a state subject. So insurgencies, when it all started, the Naxal insurgency, typically it started in West Bengal. So it was at that point of time only geospecific to one state. Then again, it suddenly sort of one saw its face in Andhra Pradesh, more or less, part of, let's Maharashtra, one or two districts. So it was indeed the, you know, Andhra Pradesh's baby. So Andhra Pradesh, it was a law and order situation at that point of time within the boundaries of Andhra Pradesh. So it was Andhra Pradesh's, you know, headache to deal with the situation. And then it went on to be in Madhya Pradesh. Then Madhya Pradesh was divided, or rather Chhattisgarh was carved out of Madhya Pradesh. And this Naxal problem continued to be synonymous with the newly carved state of Chhattisgarh. So it was Chhattisgarh government's baby and how to tackle it. So it's because law and order is a state subject, the center, the central government really doesn't come into the picture. But indeed, in 2006, when the Prime Minister sort of said it in so many words, and even a little before that, MHA was having its own sort of monitoring and assessment, and when it realized that it is indeed not just a couple of states which are sort of, they are infested with this problem, but this is becoming, and this is almost growing exponentially and growing very simultaneously in a very menacing fashion throughout the country, or at least major parts of the country and larger states of India, that's when they sort of even started looking at the problem at the central level or at the ministry level. So the military definitely has not been sort of resorted to or has been asked to intervene for various reasons. But the main reason is that we have what is called the paramilitary forces in our country. which is mostly under the control of the center. So these forces are typically deployed when there are serious situations in states. You know, it could be a communal conflagration, it could be an ethnic sort of situation. So whenever the conflicts become a little larger than life and it's difficult for the state governments to really sort of deal with it, that's when the central forces are sort of put to use. So CRPF has been deployed in large numbers. So we almost have more than 200 companies, which is like, 10 battalions or maybe 15 battalions of force in these states now who are working together with the local police. But, I mean, you would understand and appreciate that insurgency basically should be led by, I mean, counterinsurgency has to be led by the local police or should be led by the local security forces because they are that much more sort of able to appreciate and handle the situation better. So, but we do have the backup of the paramilitary now.
So we only have a few more minutes left. Are there any last questions? Maybe we can collect them and give you the opportunity to answer as many as possible, please.
Julie McCarthy with National Public Radio in the Delhi Bureau. This, I mean, you've touched on so many intriguing questions. Some overarching ones that I have still after hearing you talk is I wondered if you could really clarify to what extent the Naxalite movement has either reigned by terror or won over people locally because there are so many pathologies and social injustices that they perceive that the Naxalites may, for one reason or another, be on board over. To what extent do they enjoy support in these areas where they have gathered apace? And to what extent is there a reign of terror? The way you've cast it is, and you sort of look at the statistics, it's sort of a gathering storm over India. I wonder if you could provide us some insights into why this gathering storm is not really more openly engaged and openly discussed in India itself.
Great questions. Any other final questions? Those are two big ones.
I think that's pretty heavily discussed.
All right. Please. Hey, you want to try to tackle this?
First of all, I think... right now, it's quite part of the discourse and the policy discourse amongst the security establishments that insurgency and the Naxal insurgency in specific needs to be addressed. So there I would disagree with you that it's not being discussed. It's very much...
At the policy level, the security
apparatus,
certainly, but among the people themselves, it doesn't seem to be engaged as an issue. It's really curious.
Mm-hmm. I think...
It's perceived as something so far away.
Not really. I mean,
maybe
I think...
not in the daily papers, but in the regional press, you will see much more than you see in the New Delhi papers.
In fact, the states where this is actually happening, I think the daily newspapers will have at least 2 sheets on this, both by way of information and by way of, op-eds or small sort of, letters to the editor. So it does engage the people now. I mean, I would say that what you said would hold true for, let's say, a decade ago, but not anymore. That's one thing. And what was your first question?
The first question was, to what extent do you think there's a reign of terror? To what extent are they really addressing sort of social...
Well, as I was just talking to Milan and Frederick before I came, I would be just talking out of my intuitive sense because... I did all of this 10 years ago, and Chhattisgarh and Jharkhand have actually happened after that, So, but looks like from the way when I speak with my colleagues in Chhattisgarh and Jharkhand, looks like that there seems to be a reign of terror in these states. That situation is quite like, they're really having, taken over the sort of the agencies and that the security agencies like the police and the paramilitary are really not being able to sort of deal with this on a one-to-one basis vis-a-vis the insurgents there. So there, apparently in Chhattisgarh and in Jharkhand, things would be sort of, I would attribute it to the way you've described it. But, Andhra Pradesh right now, the situation is not like that. Again, because the police there was completely... trained and tuned to be, dealing with with the insurgents. So even today, there are some districts which will not even have a single cadre. But when a new chief of police takes over and he does what is called the crime review, the first thing you look at is that whether any of the police stations are insurgent affected. Is there even a sympathizer? That is the first thing. So, you know, the entire orientation of the police force is towards that this is indeed a priority, which is not the case of the polices in, let's say, Odisha. Odisha, it's, in fact, I think it's still growing and they're still sort of on the offensive, and the Odisha government and the police forces are kind of grappling as to how to tackle this. They really don't want to go the Andhra way because they think that it was far too offensive or for whatever reasons. So Odisha, Chhattisgarh, Jharkhand could be sort of described the way you did, but other states, maybe things are not so bad.
Sure. Last question,
now,
Seema?
We have a home minister who's said to be more of an, you know, a strong personality or with a plan.
No, you're talking of the past home minister or the present one?
the past one, sorry. under Chidambaram, was there any effort to devise a credible sort of national strategy, learning from states that were successful? Because when you say that in Punjab, the Sikh militancy was dealt with, it was using a combination of very harsh tactics and simply just killing many of the insurgents. And I don't know if there was much development or political give and take. So I was just wondering if there was any thought of replicating what you described as successful in Andhra Pradesh from the central level down to the states.
Wasn't the NCTC supposed to do that?
Well, not really. NCTC, I think, was conceived. It's still not been put in place. And I don't know when it's going to find its place, really, in the buildings. But it was conceived basically to deal with Muslim militancy. Let me put it that way. So insurgency probably can be sort of taken over, co-opted, but NCTC wasn't really created with the intent. But coming back to your question, yes, I think during the previous home minister, I would like to spell, you know, underline the previous because he's bygone. Under the previous home minister, indeed, there were some initiatives, whatever be its, you know, worth. But there were very serious initiatives made to sort of deal with the situation at a national level and to have a coordinated response to the situation and the problem. And they created a new desk in the MHA, which is called the Anti-Naxal Management Desk. I mean, what has happened thereafter is another story, but the very fact that it was conceived that we definitely need a desk on to dealing with the Naxal situation, and it's called the Anti-Naxal Management Desk, speaks for itself. It also created an apex, or rather extra sort of official body of DGPs, who were retired DGs from states like Andhra Pradesh, Chhattisgarh, and it had people, eminent police officers who have led paramilitary forces like the BSF, the CRPF, and have dealt with insurgency in the Northeast. So they had some very eminent police officers who were sort of taken as an advisory group, and a sort of official body which would be sort of giving in their inputs by way of research and study. That it had people who were not really supposed to be there, that's again another story, that's another spin. But he did take some initiatives to get, you know, at least a very synergized response to the problem. That was there, but it really hasn't seen much headway for various reasons. One, this body which was created has DGs from these states, all right, but the DGs who really didn't do much. The real DGs who actually did are sort of have been not sort of taken in or taken on board. So those are the issues. Anti-Naxal Management Desk is being handled by an Indian Administrative Service officer from a state where, you know, Naxalites haven't, you know, operated. He's from a Northeast cadre. So he doesn't have too much of, at least, hands-on experience or even hands-on sort of knowledge of what really happens. So those are the kind of, again, you know, breaks which we Indian bureaucrats always face and get into. So, but yes, initiatives were there, all right.
Thank you very much, Anjana, for joining us today, and thank you all for coming. You may have already had enough of the Carnegie for 1 week, but we are hosting tomorrow a very interesting book launch by Feroz Khan on the history of the Pakistani nuclear program. So if you want something of a completely different flavor, please join us tomorrow. The information is on our website. Thank you.